Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and I'm very happy to be joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
And Randy Olson.
Hello.
So today we are beginning a series of shows aimed at the, and notice the pause, because I don't know which word to use here, but I'm going to say for now, commemoration of, in the United States, we call it the Forgotten War, so that's why I'm not sure which word to use, because a lot of work needs to be done to just to bring the Korean War to consciousness of the average American, and we are about to mark the 70th anniversary of the Korean War, and we're using this moment to deepen our understanding about this conflict and bring you along with us. And we do this differently. The title of the show is Entering the Forest of the Forgotten War, the Barbarization of the Sky. And entering the forest is a phrase that I have used to refer to beginning the narrative. Where do we even start to understand the Korean War? Where do we begin? The traditional date that's used to begin the Korean War is June 25th, 1950, but it's not the only place to begin. Bruce Cummings, who's at the University of Chicago and is, I think, the foremost expert on the Korean War in the United States, in his book on the Korean War, notes that the beginning, the real beginning, is not June 25th, 1950. But in 1931 or 1932, pursuant to Japan's aggression in Manchuria. So we can begin this story at different dates. This is the question of where do we enter the forest? We are entering the forest with a text published in 1912 called The Barbarization of the Sky, authored by Bertha von Suttner, who we'll talk about briefly. But that's what we're doing. We are entering the forest through this work, The Barbarization of the Sky, entering the forest of the Korean War through this 1912 essay, The Barbarization of the Sky. I also want to mark today, which is Juneteenth, which is being widely celebrated in the United States, and I just want to mark that a very important moment and say that Juneteenth, this podcast is about what we call positive history. So there's a lot of history about atrocities and crimes against humanity, genocide, and so forth. But Juneteenth perhaps should be included in positive history because it is a story of emancipation. And I just want to mark that moment and say we're here on Juneteenth talking about the Korean War. This is another thing we do, is try to leverage history and connect dots. And so with that, let us just begin with a little bit about Bertha von Suttner, who wrote this 1912 essay called The Barbarization of the Sky. And to introduce us to Bertha, I'm going to ask Randy to talk a little bit about her. I want to say also that if you look at our show resources page, Randy and I did an interview with about Bertha von Suttner with, help me pronounce the name correct.
Wiam Naemu.
Yeah, thank you. Wiam Naemu. And if you want to look at that, it's actually a television interview that's on our show resources page. So, Randy, tell us a little bit about the author of this essay, Bertha von Suttner.
Sure. So this, like, the super speed version through this woman's life and why we're going to talk about her when, you know, we've just introduced something about Korea 40 years after she dies, roughly. So Bertha was born into, like, Austrian nobility. And early on in her life, she falls in love with this guy who her family does not want her to have anything to do with, named Arthur. And the deal is that if she wants to be with him, she can't stick around at home. And so she and he decide to move. And she starts developing a life for herself, right? So one of the things that she does is she moves to Paris and starts to work for this Swedish chemist as like a secretary, clerical kind of human being. And it turns out that that guy was named Alfred Nobel. And so Alfred Nobel later in his life creates the Nobel Peace Prize, among many, many other things, in order to sort of redeem his invention of dynamite. And as his lifelong love towards Bertha is like finally coming to like a fruition at the end of his life, he creates the Nobel Peace Prize because she asks him to do it. Now, in the process, like, there's an enormous amount of time between those two pockets of history, right? Like, she meets him and starts working for him, and then he dies, and there's many years in between there. And in between there, Bertha becomes this superstar in international diplomacy and is, like, leading an enormous wave of activity that there's a bunch of different names for that activity, right? There's this international peace movement stuff, and then that's connected to the international women's, like, organizations. There's enormous number of things that could fit in that wave. But suffice to say that this woman was the only one, she was the only woman who was allowed into the proceedings, into the rooms, when, like, at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, which we've talked about in the previous show. Like, why is she in there? It's because, like, her presence is unbelievably important. And so hopefully throughout the rest of today and then in the future, we're going to unpack a little bit more. But, like, the short version, she is a really enormous figure in international diplomacy before women have, like, established formal political rights.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason.
Hmm.
So
cool.
That's the short version.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And Taylor, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think you did a great job. I just would add that, you know, she was a writer, fiction and a great thinker. So today we're focusing on Barbarization of the Sky, but her book, Lay Down Your Arms, really was the reason that we had the Hague Peace Conferences in some ways, because there was so much it created such a cultural revolution. And of course there's other works and that led, like Tolstoy, that led to the Hague Peace Conference, but it pushed forward the peace movement on a cultural level. I think it really shows the power of words and great writing.
Mm. Yeah. And Lay Down Your Arms, that book that you're referring to, Die Waffen-Nieder, that was published in 1889. And as Randy said, this first Hague Peace Conference is in 1899. So that is a 10-year difference in time. And in that time, Bertha becomes hugely famous because she writes this book. She dares to write this book that demonstrates the horrors of war on the private home and as they affect a woman. And that's what Lay Down Your Arms focuses on. And so it goes into the household. So instead of the narrative about war being patriotic and about the honor of a country and there's a lot of glory, she focuses on how it impacts a family and how it impacts women in particular. And as Taylor said, before she wrote Lay Down Your Arms in 1889, she was a writer. And one of my favorite stories about Bertha is that she came to the peace movement, which had been going on for a long time, really in middle age, or around when she was around 40 years old. And she had already published a book that has not been published in English yet, but it will be, called Das Maschinenzeitalter, The Machine Age. And she had published that book, and the money that she got from publishing that book, she decided to take her husband, Arthur. I think they were in Paris at the time, and they were just hanging out with the literati of the day and sort of movers and shakers and artists. And they were just in an informal tea session, you know, just hanging out. She learned about the organized arbitration movement and this movement to create a new court, to organize the world, as we've been saying, to organize the world such that a court would be created to give states another process by which to solve disputes. And she was, as she says in her autobiography, shocked and electrified by this news. And she was like, I have to do something. I think we've all had this experience where we hear about something, probably usually something bad, and we're like, oh my God, I have to do something to stop that. In her case, she learns about this movement and says, my God, I have to do something. Well, what can she do? She can write. So this is how she comes to write this book, Lay Down Your Arms, Die Waffen Nieder, which did have, as Taylor said, this real impact on the thinking about war. And famously, Leo Tolstoy called Bertha von Suttner the Harriet Beecher Stowe of the peace movement. And Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote that wonderful book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which I finally read in law school. Okay, I had a class called Law and Literature, and I had never read Uncle Tom's Cabin, but I read it in law school, and it blew my mind, that book. And so Harriet Beecher Stowe did the same thing. So she took the abolition movement and she sort of brought it to life for the average person through literature. So Bertha does the same thing. And so, yeah, that's why she's there in 1899, 10 years later. She famously says, I did not become a peace activist and then write Lay Down Your Arms. I wrote Lay Down Your Arms and then I became a peace activist. So first came the book, then became her lifelong devotion to the cause. Her first work of writing, published work, is published in 1883, called Inventarium Inner Sela, which means an inventory of a soul. That also has not been published in English, but it will be. So if you're interested in more about Bertha, there is the Bertha von Suttner Project, berthavonsuttner.com. Links are on our show resources page. And, of course, today we're talking about this book, The Barbarization of the Sky, published in 1912. Before I move to barbarization, any final thoughts on Bertha, any other biographical anecdotes, et cetera, that anybody wants to get in?
Yeah, I'll add one thing just to sort of round out part of the picture. You know, there's a question about, okay, so if she cannot attend these, like, official meetings, like, how is this woman having this enormous influence on what's happening within these meetings? And basically, she creates this amazing, like, it would be the equivalent of a super press conference in a big hotel on the beach north of where the meetings were actually taking place. And so, like, the journalists and the politicians and other activists would all go meet at this place, Kurhaus, which is like, it's like a big, beautiful hotel on, you know, on the water. And they would meet there and discuss things and talk. And it was like a social club almost. And it was called the salon, like a salon. And, you know, there was this, like, she organizes this other channel through which people who are not official politicians, who are not diplomats, who are not ambassadors or emissaries, can begin to be part of the conversation. And there's something so extraordinary because, you know, nobody else was doing that. She does. Mm-hmm. And it's like just as another example of, well, I need to do something. And then, boom, it creates this whole mechanism to give more people a seat at the table.
Yeah, that's a really valuable point. Thank you for adding that. And that's at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference that she does that salon. And the next peace conference to come after that, which we will talk about at the end of the show, I think, is the 1907 Hague Peace Conference, which is very, very important to Korean history, number one.
Yeah.
And not only does she bring to like these sort of like-minded people, and this is before we have the term NGO, which is a UN term. I think it's Article 71 of the UN Charter refers to non-governmental organizations. But yeah, she is getting these organizations together. Journalists and diplomats would come and consort. Not so many, but they would come and consort with her. Very sadly, so much of the stuff is not translated into English. And Bertha von Suttner did keep a diary of her experience at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, which is in Dutch. It has not been translated into English, so something that we have to put on in the hopper for our work. But what ends up happening out of that is this official newsletter for the 1907 Hague Peace Conference called the Courrier de la Conférence, and there is on the show resources page if you're interested in seeing what that looks like. You can click on, there's a link number 5 on the show resources page. You can see what it looks like, and you will see on the masthead her name, Bertha von Suttner. This is at the 1907 Hague Peace Conference, and again, we'll get to it, very important to Korean history. Taylor, anything else you want to add to this before we transition to barbarization of the sky?
No, I think we've covered the basics, and I'm excited to discuss further.
Cool. All right, then. Well, let's get into barbarization of the sky. If you look at the little image that we've used for the show, and a larger image of that you can see on the Twitter feed, the Bertha von Suttner Facebook page, you'll see that the original is a sort of like orange cover in German. And if you look at the circular image, it says in German, organize the world. This is a theme that we have been talking about. And this is one of the logos of Die Friedenswart, which was a newsletter, a journal that was started by one of Bertha von Suttner's protégés. But so there's that connection. But it's originally published in German in 1912. It has only been translated into two languages. One would be Japanese, and the other would be English. And the Bertha von Suttner published the English translation a couple years ago in part, and here's a connection to Korean War, in part to commemorate the 20th anniversary of an important decision that came out, sorry for all this verbiage, of the International Court of Justice, which is the court of the UN. We are talking about pre-UN history, but let me just say that there is a court of the UN, International Court of Justice, and in 1996, they had an advisory opinion on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. So when we're talking about the barbarization of the sky, perhaps the use of nuclear weapons is the, as I say in the foreword, the apotheosis, the most extreme version of the barbarization of the sky is the dropping of nuclear weapons. So that's one connection. So we published it that year to draw attention to that ICJ opinion, on the advisory opinion on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons, and also to draw attention to this essay, which had not been translated into English. There's a link on the show resources page. It's sold at the Peace Palace gift shop in The Hague, the Netherlands. And it's available in some libraries. But she writes this in 1912, and as I was working on this book, and finally having it translated, I learned from it that she's not this sort of warning against using the skies as a theater of war was not hers alone. In fact, at both the 1899 and 1907 Hague Peace Conferences, there was a declaration it's called something like the prohibition of dropping explosives from balloons. So numerous states agreed in 1899 and then in 1907 that they were not going to be dropping things from the sky. The 1899 agreement was a 5-year long agreement, and it was renewed in 1907. And you can read more about that in the little text, The Barbarization of the Sky. But what happens is Bertha, who's very aware of what states have pledged in 1899 and 1907, sees in 1912 the states are not doing what they said they would do. And they're starting to drop things from the sky. And she refers to Italians dropping explosives in Libya. So this is the context in which she's writing. It's sort of like she's trying to hold states accountable for what they pledged they would do, reminding them of what they said, and then saying, this is like why you should not do this. Okay. I also want to say that when we published this text, there are numerous references to Korea. You may be wondering, where's the discussion about the Korean War? It's coming. We're entering the forest through a different wood, if you will. But Korea is mentioned numerous times. The dropping of what is called ordnance, that's a euphemism because no one wants to say bombs. People use the word ordnance, which is funny to me because ordnance also means like law, like the ordinance of a town. But it's also used to refer to explosives and munitions. So this is how people talk, that we dropped ordnance, a lot of it, in North Korea. We dropped napalm in North Korea. So that's mentioned in The Barbarization of the Sky, as well as some massacres that occurred, which we will be talking about, one of which is the Nogun Ri massacre. And I must say that I think it's very poignant that Randy and Taylor are with me today because all of us were at Nogun Ri in 2015. You'll learn about it. And this was the site of a massacre at the very beginning of the Korean War. And Nogun Ri has a peace academy every year. It's canceled this year. And it was very sad because this year, they had a lot planned for the 70th anniversary of the Korean War, but because of COVID, this has all stopped. But both Randy and Taylor were there, as was I, as part of this Nogun Ri Peace Academy 5 years ago. So that will be coming up, and that involves stories about how the United States was using the skies during the Korean War. So that's a little bit about... Anything else about the book that people want to add? I think that I've said quite a bit.
Yeah, in the same vein as earlier, I think that just providing like a general structure might be useful for people who, you know, this might be the first time they're hearing anything about this. And so, you know, it's useful to think that, you know, we know that the Wright brothers put the first flying machine airplane in the sky, right? And that happened in 1903. So before then, there was things that would fly in the sky, but it was mostly like air balloons. And in 1903, they finally managed to get a motor to lift something that was heavier than air up into the sky, and that changed everything. And so, like, over the next 10 years, there was this arms race for who can mobilize and weaponize the sky the fastest. And that story is, you know, unpacked at least in part in this essay. And so it's like, here's what people started to do. And then here's the lies that were happening and how people said, oh, it's going to be like airplanes are going to bring an end to war because nobody's going to be able to fight wars in the same way. And, you know, in the essay, Bertha explains how, like, all of that was totally not what was actually happening. And so there's a lot more, obviously, but that's, like, the picture.
Yeah. And we tried to draw attention to this deeper history that you're referring to about balloons and also zeppelins. And there are numerous images in the in this little book. And balloons, I've heard, I haven't like verified sources, but they were used by Napoleon mostly. That he did drop some things from them. I haven't fact checked that. I do know that during the Civil War, balloons were used for reconnaissance purposes. So Thaddeus Lowe worked for the Union Army, and amazingly would like go up, ascend in a hot air balloon, and actually I think it was a hydrogen balloon. I can't recall, but there's a difference. And he would go up with a spyglass and observe the movements of the enemy. And then he had a telegraph up there with him, and he would communicate on the telegraph. It would be sent down to the ground, and then he would have a runner to take it to the general. So that's what people thought. And Bertha very quickly mentions like the reconnaissance use of aerial vehicles. She's really worried about the dropping of explosives from these vehicles and not just the reconnaissance purpose. But anyway, if you're interested, there's some photographs that try to get at that deeper history. And it's a fascinating history, and I have to confess that I wasn't, you know, thinking about the sky in that way until I started working on this text. And there's a lot to learn. Anything else? Taylor, you want to add anything about the text?
Yeah, they're going kind of off of the idea about, you know, this arms race. She quotes, I'm going to quote from page 21 of the essay.
Okay.
She wrote, "Yes, it should be stopped. Meanwhile, what is happening? It's being prepared. It's true, we are only at the beginning, and yet how far have we succeeded in preparing the war in the air?" And then she goes on to discuss how France and Germany and Austria are all preparing for this arms race. And it's interesting because you can kind of see parallels with that even today with new technologies that emerge. And you can see that in Korea in particular, which we're discussing the Korean War, but there's always this idea of being prepared for war building up arms race. And we see that at the DMZ border. There's just so much preparation for war, even though, you know, we say we don't want war. We're very prepared for it. And so even though she was giving a warning about, you know, how the war in the sky could really cause so much devastation, she also wasn't necessarily novel in that thinking because clearly she recognized that the governments were already preparing for it. And I think it's something that we should keep in mind, especially as we approach the Korean War, about how governments were preparing for that war and how the militarization on both sides kind of sets the stage for that.
I'd like to pick up from that, actually, if that's okay. This idea that, you know, we're preparing for war is something that is amazingly overlooked, you know, at least in my worldview. Like, I forget routinely that these are things that are unbelievably well-organized, like, machines for destruction. And the way that ends up occurring must include all sorts of, like we'll just point out like funding, and you need to publicize things in certain ways in order to continue to get that kind of funding. And you know, there's another quote from the essay that it does the better job than I've done at unpacking this. But, you know, Bertha says, "Unfortunately, the most effective demonstrations so far have been held in a warlike spirit because they are the loudest, because they are supported by the highest authorities, and because they always push the complacent masses onto familiar emotional tracks. onto which they so easily allow themselves to be guided, according to the law of least resistance. And we see this happen all the time. It's almost like it's just the way things are, so it seems, where, yeah, well, of course we're going to have a percentage of our population at an early age go prepare to kill other people. And of course a huge percentage of our budget is going to go to fund all the weaponry and the research for new weaponry that is going to lead to these kinds of things in the future. And then there's like this media campaign that publicizes information about that. And there's these, you know, think about TV advertisements. Like, this kind of thing is this huge machine that's all very well organized. And it was the same way 108 years ago when she's writing this essay. It's like the newspapers were doing the same thing then. So
yeah.
I'll stop there.
All right, Taylor, do you have a response to any of that? If not, I can speak. I just want to give you the chance
to. No, I just think it's interesting because barbarization of the sky happened before World War One. Or it was published before World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's talking about this arms buildup, and when we're talking about preparation of war and preparing the citizenry to get behind wars, they were preparing for World War One long, you know, before it happened. And, you know, whether it's a conscious decision to the public or not, when you see preparation, when you're preparing your technologies to be used as arms, you're basically creating the conditions that make war almost inevitable. And even though we might clearly recognize that we don't want war, and that, you know, these technologies would make it worse for everyone if they're used in a conflict, we still somehow find ourselves there. And so, you know, as to, like, for Andy's quote or for Randy's quote, they're it's a conscious decision that they're preparing for.
And indeed, thank you so much for reminding us that this essay is before World War One, because if you Google preparedness and World War One, you'll see it's a thing. It was a thing in the United States, and it was a shift in policy, because as you guys know, and as Bertha von Suttner reminds us in her memoirs, there was a peace movement. There was a pre-World War One peace movement. And as we said on the very first show of this podcast, May 18th, the original Peace Day, she says, what you're doing in the United States is absolutely revolutionary. You'll never see this done in Europe. You celebrate Peace Day. You're talking about this. You guys are dreamers, this kind of thing. And indeed, we were until... and we did not enter World War One until 1917. We were out of it, okay, from 1914 until 1917. And the way that we got into it was in part preparedness, in large part preparedness, and there, you know, there's other things, but preparedness was this thing that got us moving towards that machine that you're talking about. There's a lot there. The other thing I wanted to say, this quote that Randy mentioned, and this quote is on page 3132, and this the familiar emotional tracks of the compliant masses, that these are sort of like, it's psychological inertia. So I'm going to read that this part of the quote again. The highest authorities always push the compliant masses onto familiar emotional tracks, onto which they so easily allow themselves to be guided according to the law of least resistance. So that if you don't exert an appropriate counterforce, you're going to be swept away. And I want to say this counterforce is not only, you know, this sort of like we take for granted this preparedness. This is just something that This is just how it's done. This is the way things are. But also, there's a lot that's not, like, there's a lot of information that doesn't make it into mainstream media. And just recently, President Trump, and he's not the only one. There's a lot of companies that urged him to do this, but broadened something called the MTCR, which is the Missile Technology Control Regime, which prevented the sale of armed drones. But now the United States is selling them. Okay, so this just happened. And so we're going to be dealing with sales of armed drones to places like Saudi Arabia and so forth. And this is also part of this, you know, the familiar emotional. It's not just what we're told, it's what's kept from us and what's not really part of any kind of debate. And I also want to say a familiar emotional track, which I tried to draw attention to, I think, last week's show. It's known, you know, lex talionis, which is the law of retaliation, or an eye for an eye. So you harm me, I harm you. And the legitimacy of harm. Now, this is something that we totally take for granted, that we can use harm and coercion to enforce our will onto other states. And part of that harm and coercion does and can involve military force. But, you know, the whole doctrine of it's legitimate to use harm and pain, that, you know, I guess you would call them idealists, it has been questioned. I mean, Socrates, I always like to point to him, says you never should return harm for harm, even if you've been harmed. But built into the very structure of, you know, international relations and diplomacy is what's called the law of coercion. And there's a recent book out called The Law of Coercion, The Power to Hurt in International Relations. I mean, that's the subtitle. And that's a legitimate, it's a legitimate thing. And so sanctions, military force, and, like, hurting people to enforce your will is totally legitimate, and I think that's a familiar emotional track, as is just apathy. And Bertha draws attention to apathy as well in her writings and in this text. I'll leave it open to anybody to comment.
Yeah.
And if you want to, and of course, if you want to call in, you know, you probably see the number if you're listening on Blog Talk Radio. Sorry, 516-387-1449. 516-387-1449. Go ahead.
So, just briefly, you know, when we think about familiar emotional tracks, I can't move forward until we address that. You know, human beings in, you know, something like a state of nature situation are not like happy, peaceful, everything is good, you know, paradise. It's like if you take a human being and you drop them in the middle of the woods, they got about 3 seconds before panic mode is going to be the only experience they have, followed by conflict and struggle and pain and war. And it's not until very, very long into that process when you get something that's an organized, civilized, structured society. Right, there's a huge difference between those two places. And of course, I've just, you know, flew through an enormous number of philosophical categories, but the baseline for human beings is a place of fear, and then only after, once certain things get built up, do we arrive at a place where something like peace is even possible. And so I'm just trying to loop that back into this idea of organize the world. Why is that connected to peace? Because without organized structures, humanity is going to slide into somewhere scary, like every time. And it's super easy to push the structure over and everything will land in that fear place again. And so, like, when people want to tear things down, they have to understand that the place where it goes, you know, go to the Bible, right? Like, you leave the tyranny, you end up in the desert. You don't end up in paradise right away. So that's, you know, I just feel like that's a useful philosophical anecdote.
Hmm.
With when it comes to talking about familiar emotional territory, I think it's, you reminded me of the point that it's, as you've discussed before, important for the amelioration of humanity to first establish peace within yourself, and that we only can really progress and resist the sort of push towards war that, you know, governments want us to follow along with, if we're able to resist our emotions of fear and anger and resentment. And so I think that's an important point to just put in there for when discussing that.
Yes.
Quote.
So overcoming what is referred to as the talionic impulse, which is this, I think is maybe the default impulse to retaliate, you know, like you've harmed me, I must harm you. But that needs to be overcome. And so a lot of wisdom traditions, you know, focus on the inner work that's required to do that. So, yeah, that's definitely, I mean, so again, let's give it up to Cora de Brezza, because that was her whole approach. As we've said before, you begin with the germ, you begin with the individual. And then, and Tolstoy makes the same point. It's not about having these structures. You do need the structures, but they're necessary but not sufficient for what we're after. And there needs to be this inner work. Let me, go ahead, last point, then I'll get to this third quote that needs to be mentioned.
Go there, and then I was going to transition us into Korea. So go there first.
Cool. Yeah, because this does help us go into Korea. So we've been talking about the barbarization of the sky and focusing on various quotes therein. And I'm going to sort of end with this final quote, and then we're going to pivot to Korea. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the 1907 Hague Peace Conference is very important to Korean history, number one. As we've also mentioned, Bertha von Suttner was organizing the what we would now call NGO community around both conferences, the 1899 Hague Peace Conference and the 1907. And at the 1907 Hague Peace Conference, as we mentioned, there was a newspaper. I think it was published every week, called the Courrier de la Conférence. It's published in French, all in French. So I've had portions of it translated, but I'm going to read you something that is mentioned in the foreword of the Barbarization of the Sky. So it's not Bertha writing. It is someone else, and that someone else is myself writing the foreword. And I refer to this this speech that she gives. So the NGO community around both of these early Hague Peace Conferences, the 1907 one, they called themselves the International Circle or Circle International. And it was just like a bunch of cosmopolitans fighting the good fight. And they would meet, and they had a newsletter. And so at one of their meetings, Bertha gave a talk called Air War, or Luftkrieg in German. She gave a talk on it at the 1907 Hague Peace Conference. And I sort of referenced that in the foreword of Barbarization of the Sky. And I'm just going to read my commentary. She shares the thoughts of a Lieutenant Colonel Regala of Bieberstein, Germany, who states that the new weapon should be banned, not only because of its, quote, morale effect on the troops, but also because introducing a new weapon would force states to shoulder additional economic burdens arising from the need to develop newer weapons, newer industries, even to combat the balloons. So a couple of things I want to say. Yes, this does relate to Korea. Number one, we can't go into it now, but just mark it, 1907, very important, 1907 Hague Peace Conference, important for Korean history. Number two, the date of this article is June 25th, 1907, and June 25th being the date traditionally associated with the outbreak of hostilities on the Korean Peninsula, known as the Korean War, June 25th, 1950, but this is June 25th, 1907. Number three, this morale, the effect on morale. We could also call that the psychological effect of aerial bombardment, which, as we will discuss, plays a huge role in the Korean War. And this, it's spelled moral effect, but it's pronounced morale effect. And there's, you know, some debates amongst whatever, like aerial tacticians about whose morale we're going to go after with this aerial bombardment. Because some say, look, we have to go after the morale of the troops and just get them to desert. Like, this is just hopeless. This is hopeless, and there are these air weapons in the sky, and we need to flee. That's, you know, the objective of destroying the morale. And we'll get into that when we talk about psyops in a couple of weeks, or psychological warfare, as was used in the Korean War. Also, some in the Royal Air Force have, and this influenced the United States thinking in the Korean War and also in Vietnam. The morale doesn't just include soldiers. It includes the people. And it only includes, you know, the quote-unquote enemy, but also includes, like, the side waging the war and the public support of the war. So I like this passage, or even this phrase, the effect on morale, because it draws into our attention the role of psychology in warfare and the specific role that aerial bombardment plays in that psychology and the very specific role that it plays in the Korean War. So I leave it open to anyone to comment on that bit.
Well, I have, you know, I think you've unpacked that rather well, and I'd like to return to something that you said shortly before this about the idea that there's something that's acceptable at the international level. Like, it's okay to use pain and coercion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this idea to me is very useful to transition us all the way into what actually started to occur. So the question is, you know, if it's okay to use pain and coercion, what isn't it okay to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the layperson, like, perhaps war is this anything goes situation, right? That would be the default assumption. If pain and coercion are okay, well, what's not? And it turns out that there's a lot of things that are not acceptable during wartime. There's a whole field of it called humanitarian law, oddly enough. But in any case, one example of something that is not okay to do during a war happened in Nogunri, which is a town in South Korea. And basically, in 1950, right away during the, like, official, like, the war is officially happening, about a month after the official start date, which we talked about how that's, like, a complicated, like, when do we say that it began? But at the end of July in 1950, a bunch of Korean civilians were being escorted from their town where they live. They were told they had to leave, and they were being sent to go somewhere else. And while they were walking on the, like, walking down the street, more or less, they got gunned down by U.S. military. And there's, like, a chain of command problem and miscommunication that made it so that the people on the ground weren't sure, and then they were sure, and there's a bunch of history behind it. But basically, one example of something that you cannot do in a war is shoot people who you know are civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened at Nogunri. And so
mm-hmm.
that's sort of part of our transition here.
Yeah, and we'll talk about Nogunri in detail in future shows. But yes, there are things on paper. And so this goes back to Bertha's point. Sure, we have, you know, these, to refer to an earlier episode of something called the Korea Review, they refer to the scraps of paper in the Hague. And this, by the way, is a little newspaper published by Korean students in the United States in 1919. And they refer to the scraps of paper in the Hague. Long story. But sure, we have laws. And this is Bertha's point, that, you know, in 1912, states said they wouldn't, or sorry, 19, of 7 and 1899, states said they wouldn't do this, but here they are doing it. So that there needs to be, you know, some sort of accountability, and we need to stop them. And if you think that, like do something, that's the sort of end of her essay. Like, maybe you think it's futile, but everything helps, she says. You must do something. So she writes this little essay, and it's been transmitted to us over 100 years later. But, yeah, we have this stuff, but is it enforced, number one? And we will share, when we talk about No Gun Ri, the actual, you know, these the victims of No Gun Ri are, you know, incredible because, you know, they themselves went into the National Archives and did all of this research with the help of the AP, Associated Press, Charles Hanley and his partner Martha Mendoza. They really sort of cracked the story. But they found, you know, actual documents in which the U.S. Army said, yeah, just fire on anything. Just fire on anything. There's no distinction made, and this was pointed out that this violates the laws of war. So what happened? So we'll talk about that. Taylor, you want to add anything? As you've been to No Gun Ri.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And on that same trip, we also went to Jeju Island, which is an island in South Korea. And I think, you know, a very similar story. There's a big museum there and a foundation, a special like task force that got together, I think, in 2000. A committee in 2000 that got together and investigated the killings of many citizens and basically the armed conflict that occurred on that island in 1948 on April 3rd. And it was called the Jeju 4-3 incident. We attended the Peace Academy, went to that island that year and learned about that as well. And it's similar in that they had to dig up the history themselves, and they issued a pretty large report that I'm sure you can find online called the Incident Investigation, the Jeju 4-3 Incident Investigation Report. And so it kind of, it's similar in that there are many atrocities that they committed, even though humanitarian law said that they could not.
Right. And for, yeah, am I cutting you off? Do you want to say more? Because I have
No, go ahead. No, go ahead. Yeah, please.
I just wanted to say also that, as you point out, the Jeju massacre is 1948. Oh, that's before 1950, right? That's before June 25th, 1950. And indeed, I really don't think you can understand the Korean War without understanding not the Jeju massacre, okay, but what is the Jeju massacre about? It's about the election in Korea. That's what the Jeju incident is about. We don't have time to talk about it, but just, you know, mark it that you can see this timeline being laid out. So we have 1912, barbarization of the sky. We've been, drawing attention to just to the air, and yes, P.S., it's coming, because the air is really, really important. Air warfare is really important in the Korean War. So we've talked about that. We've mentioned No Gun Ri. We'll be developing that. That is a massacre committed in the early opening of the Korean War before the Chinese enter, which is another complication. So that's 1950. But as Taylor's pointing out, there's this other thing that happens in 1948 on April 3rd, and the official election, the very first election in the South, which the moderates in Korea did not want to have because they knew that it would cause the 38th parallel, which is not an international boundary at the time. The 38th parallel was drawn, and sorry, there's no good way to get, it's just too complex, so we're just getting it all out. But the 38th parallel, so there's the 38th parallel and there's the DMZ. They're two different lines important to understanding the Korean War. The 38th parallel was drawn basically the week that we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We divided Korea before Japan formally surrendered. The United States divided Korea Jewel Line and divided the southern part from the northern part, and that's called the 38th parallel. So in the beginning, the 38th parallel was just like delineating zones of occupation, the south to be occupied by the United States, the north to be occupied by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was charged with demilitarizing the northern part, and the United States was charged with demilitarizing the southern part, demilitarizing meaning getting rid of, you know, the vestiges of Japan's colonialism, which we haven't mentioned, and their weapons and so forth. And so the United States and Russia were supposed to figure out a path to eventual unification, which didn't happen. It's a very long story, but let's just say that there were elections in the South that Southern moderates, such as Kim Kyushik, did not want to happen and was protesting against these elections, which were monitored and supervised by the United Nations. And the Jeju massacre was in response to that. And it's quite in keeping with, you know, coercion and violence being a legitimate means by which to get someone to do something that they don't want to do. I mean, that's what coercion is where you get, you use pain to get someone to do something that they don't want to do. So there's a little timeline there. And I didn't know anything about the Jeju massacre until I learned about it from Dr. Chung Kudo of the Nogonri Peace Foundation. And I didn't know anything about Nogonri until I met him in The Hague in 2013. Both Randy and Taylor have been with me in The Hague and in Korea, so this is all connected. And we've been trying to connect this Hague lost history, Bertha von Suttner, her writings, with where we are today, because there's absolutely a connecting thread. We have like 2 minutes left, so let me start with Randy and see if you have anything you want to close out with.
Yeah, I'll do the fastest world history lesson I can imagine. So just to give the framework for where we're going, 30 seconds. So Japan asked Korea if they can bring their troops to the mainland to fight the Russians. On their way out, they're supposed to leave peacefully, and instead they make Korea sign away all of their political rights. This happens before the Second Hague Peace Conference. This is before World War One. So turns out Japan still owns Korea all the way until the end of the Second World War. And so when we, the United States, drop nukes on Japan, we start to have to decide what to do with Japan's territory. And then we have this line drawn down the middle of Korea. We decide to force elections on the country. And when the people in Korea decide to protest those elections, we kill 30,000 of their civilians on one island. And that was almost the entire population of the island. More goes on after that, but that's the story.
And Taylor, anything you want to add? Taylor, are you there with us? Maybe Taylor has stepped away.
Sorry.
Oh,
tech.
There you are.
Yeah, you can see the preparation for war in throughout the history of the Korean Peninsula, that people were preparing it in a way for violence, and that's very different than how to prepare for peace and how to bring about peace in the area.
Mm. And I'll just say, like, yeah, the issue of nuclear, like, all tying all of this together really is nuclear weapons. This is why we released the translation when we did, drawing attention to this advisory opinion, very controversial opinion, actually, but there it is on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. And I want to, you know, end by saying that opinion, you know, earlier Randy asked the question, well, what allowed in war? And we have these laws and so forth. But if you read that advisory opinion, basically, and the United States position was and still is, pretty much anything is allowed as long as it serves a necessary and compelling military objective. And so the United States position is on nuclear weapons, at least in 1996, and I have no reason to think that it's changed because we've built up our nuclear arsenal, even though when we've pledged in the Nonproliferation Treaty to denuclearize, but everybody's building up, preparing. But they say, look, and the justices said, if a state really has to use it, it can. If it really comes down to the, quote, survival of a state, these nuclear weapons can be used. Now, take that and think about the existential meaning of that to North Korea, right? And so they saw that when nuclear weapons were used, Japan surrendered. They see the power of nuclear weapons, and they're not very easily going to give up that power. That is where we are today. It is extremely complex. We hope that you have brought you along with us. We hope to be back next week continuing this conversation. And so you have been listening to Virtues of Peace. Check out our show resources page to continue doing the deep dive. It's really complex. And all of us do this show to help us, the hosts, more deeply understand. Am I speaking incorrectly for y'all, or is that true?
No, it's certainly important for me to revisit this story often in order to really package it into my understanding.
Yeah. So now is the time, because things on the Korean Peninsula are escalating, the hostilities are escalating, and it's a time of great concern. We leave it there. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Take care and happy Juneteenth, 2020. Bye.
Bye.